So here I am in Frederick's apartment. My name's Bruce Dickinson, and I'm from, well, Earth.
I'm so happy to have you here, Bruce. Thanks for showing up. I just listened to your new solo record, The Mandrake Project.
Yeah.
And it's not only a record, but it's also a comic book about a shaman-like figure called Dr. Necropolis.
Uh-huh.
What's, like, the gist of the story?
Without giving it away, because it's a three-year project, like with a 12 episodes and everything. Episode one, you discover that there's this project been going on for a few years that's now come to kind of culmination. And it's one, to prove the existence of the human soul as a physical entity, and secondly, to store it. To capture it and store it and then do something else with it. So Dr. Necropolis is part of that project, along with Professor Lazarus, who runs the project, and quite what Necropolis's role in it becomes apparent as we go through the book. But they both have different ideas and motivations for wanting the project to succeed. They both get what they think they want, but it's not what they expect.
The Mandrake Project, that title made me think of the Manhattan Project.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You sort of get this apocalyptic vibe from it.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And there's, you know, I like to have the idea of this kind of like shadowy organization, a bit of kind of like a semi-conspiratorial thing going on, you know, but like big money behind it, you know, and shadowy figures running it, you know.
Also, mandrake is a root with hallucinogenic effects.
Yes, it is. Very, very strong hallucinogenic effects. In fact, mandrake root tincture can bring on these very profound hallucinations. But too much of it will actually kill you. It'll stop your heart.
Also, the root itself kind of looks like a human being.
That's right.
So it looks a bit spooky if you Google pictures of mandrake roots.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I mean, most people have probably heard of mandrake roots because of Harry Potter. But before that, mandrake roots were thought to have powers, magical powers, because they looked like human beings. And they were... all these stories of like magicians in the or occultists, whatever you want to call them, in the Middle Ages, who believed that when you pulled a mandrake root from the ground, it would emit a shriek, and that shriek would kill a human being. So the idea was that you had to get... there's this really funny story about how to pull a mandrake from the ground, and it involved putting earplugs in and getting a dog and tying the dog to the mandrake root and then giving the dog a kick up the arse, and the dog pulls the root out of the ground and the dog dies. And I was like, okay, that's a really, really long, long way round, you know.
Have you, for the sake of like research, tried mandrake root tea yourself?
No, I haven't. No, I actually have to confess, I'm very disappointing in terms of mushrooms or anything else like that, or anything that's like vaguely hallucinogenic, because I have quite vivid things go on in my imagination, and I'm always a little bit, I'm frankly a little bit worried of what would happen. So I don't need to take trippy things to take a trip, if you see what I mean.
A person called Necropolis was mentioned in the song If Eternity Should Fail.
Uh-huh.
That's on Iron Maiden's Book of Souls album from 2015. And you've re-recorded that track and retitled it to Eternity Has Failed.
Yes.
On this record. So why did you change the title, and have you been planning this project for so long?
Yeah, it sounds like it. It's with hindsight, you can always look and say, ah, he was secretly planning it all along. And I've actually gone back through some of my records and realized that, you know, I wasn't secretly planning it, but possibly my subconscious was. So the title. So back in 2014, I wrote the song, If Eternity Should Fail. The title was going to be the title to what I was intending to be a solo album. the title was actually from a Doctor Strange episode from a comic book. So there's an episode of Doctor Strange called If Eternity Should Fail, and I just saw it, and the cover was magnificent. I was like, oh my God, what a great cover. What an amazing title for a record, If Eternity Should Fail. So I wrote the song, and I thought maybe I could do some kind of comic with the album. That would be a kind of cool vibe. But I should do like a little mini story or something in there. And then I thought back to a track I had on the album Accident of Birth, the title track, in fact. And that was a story about a guy who was tortured by his sibling who died at birth. And they're separated, but one of them's kind of in hell. But he can see he's psychically linked. So although he's in this world, half of him is in hell with his brother. And it tortures him. And he's like, you know, why have you, you know, who's done this to me? Why am I like this, you know? I thought of that story. And I went, imagine that there was a way of bringing his brother back from hell. What would that look like? And I didn't know, but I invented two characters, Dr. Necropolis and Professor Lazarus. And I was like, imagine there was a project that could do that. And you have these two guys, and they both want to use the project for different reasons. One wants to use it for the benefit of mankind. The other one wants to just make a load of money out of it. So that was the basis of the spoken word, which was just done as a... an experiment, really. So I was in Roy, my guitarist, the producer. I was in his living room, but exactly like this, you know, I mean, except with like some guitars. And we'd put the basic track down. And I said, I want to try this kind of like spoken word thing, you know. And it was really just off the cuff, like a sketch, to say, I wonder what it would sound like if we had a narration going through the album, you know. And so I did that, you know, narration. I'm very proud of the word bile on that. It sounds particularly nasty, you know. I filled them, they're living corpses, with my bile. I'm like, oh yes, bile, you know.
A bit of a gross word.
Yes, yeah, just gross, the way it sounds. Word, exactly, you know. I love the shape of it, you know. So then the album, that got kind of like borrowed for Iron Maiden, and they put it on Book of Souls, which I was like, yeah, cool, okay, fine. And bizarrely, they kept the spoken word. And I was like, okay, that's cool, but why? Because it means there's no relevance whatsoever and completely meaningless to the outside listener, you know, because who's this Necropolis bloke and who's his son he's talking about and what, hey, what? So, fast forward through 2014, 2015, and then throat cancer, and then working like crazy and flying 747s with Iron Maiden, and then COVID, lockdown, we're all locked up, nothing to do. What are you going to think about while you're locked up? And the answer is I did a load of binge watching of Netflix, which I'd never been able to do before because I never had time. And I wrote the script for the Iron Maiden video, Writing on the Wall, which features the four bikers of the apocalypse, all of them Eddies. And that came because I was watching a show called Sons of Anarchy, which is like a biker soap opera type thing. Unbelievably well written. A guy called Kurt Sutter was the author. And via a roundabout route, via a friend of mine called Sasha Gervaisi, who's a Hollywood scriptwriter, we were doing Zoom calls because it's all you could do, just chatting and about writing and telling stories to each other. And I mentioned Sons of Anarchy and Kurt, and he went, oh, Kurt's a mate of mine, let's have a Zoom together. So we had every couple of weeks, we'd have a couple of hours of just telling stories between three writers of things. And I started to develop the idea of the comic because I had nothing else to do. And I thought, oh, well, let me see where we could go with this. And I changed the story around quite a bit. And I put I combined some elements in Necropolis. So he's really quite a disturbed figure, and therefore quite interesting. And then I started to populate a whole universe around him. So, you know, he's an orphan. He doesn't know where he comes from. He has some powers, but he doesn't know why he has them. And he also can't control them. But he also happens to be a genius. So he has abilities, like intellectual abilities. And he's essential to the Mandrake Project. And you find out why as you go through the story. But then who are the other people? And why are they doing it? What are their motivations? And so you build up this family, kind of twisted family. And then I went, well, what's the backstory? Where did their family come from? How did this whole thing start? Where did it start? Why did it start? So I was basically world building. And when I built the world, I was on a Zoom with Kurt and Sasha, and I said, Kurt, mate, I've got this crazy idea. I'm going to run it past you. And I told him the idea. And he went, yeah, that's a really good idea. I mean, honestly? He went, yeah, it's a really good idea. No bullshit. It's a really good idea. Go for it. I went, how? I mean, you know, what do I do? I mean, what, I'm going to write a script and send it to Netflix? He goes, no, don't do that. He said, because they'll just ignore it. He said, you should do a comic. I went, I was thinking of doing a comic. He said, absolutely do a comic. He said, here's how comics work. He said, it's four comics is one book. And then I went, okay. I said, I don't know how many comics this would be. And maybe, I was thinking of like two, but maybe four. It's 12. So by the time I started to write a synopsis of every episode, I was like, oh my God, we can't do this in one, two, three, four. Oh, what happens at comic four? Oh, wow. Now we're into, hit your microphone. Now we're into book two. Now we're into book three. So it becomes a 12 episode thing. And suddenly I'm thinking, this is kind of like Watchmen, you know, that sort of vibe. So I'm really quite excited about all this. and I didn't know where to go with it. So, and I was doing the thinking of I'm at this point, I'm thinking of doing the album after lockdown. As soon as lockdown gets done, I'm going to go to America. I'm going to do the things I wanted to do that I couldn't do for all those years, and start writing with Roy and let's get it done, you know. But I went there with this comic idea pretty fully formed, and I didn't realize, but the comic company that Kurt suggested I talk to, Z2, was a company that Maiden were already working with for their 40th anniversary of Peace of Mind book, which is amazing, by the way. It's really, really cool. So I'm just sitting there having breakfast with them, and I kind of pulled these papers out from my bag and went, you know, I've got this nuts idea for a comic, and it's not like a one-off that you do normally. It's actually a long process, and I'm going to run it past. I ran it past them. They're comic people, so they get it. And they were like, that's great. I mean, that's really... have you got the characters? I went, oh, my God, look, here's the character sketches. Look, here's the backstory. They went, oh, wow. Hang on a minute. We'll hook you up with somebody to do the script. So that's Tony Lee. Tony Lee is like Eisner Award winner and everything, and he's worked with loads of people. Staz Johnson is doing the art for the actual comic, and he's amazing as well. Bill Sienkiewicz came on board, and we had a Zoom with Bill because he's kind of A-list.
Yeah, he's famous for his Elektra comics that he made in the 80s.
And
did Batman as well, I think.
Yeah, so he's just done everything, you know. And so I thought, you know, this is a guy who's this is a proper artist. There's no point in trying to say, oh, you should do this because you can make some money, because he's not interested. So I just told him what the project was, and I told him what the philosophy behind it was. Because by now I'd developed a kind of, in the same way that Watchmen has a philosophy running through it. You don't find out until like the last two or three episodes, the whole thing about Dr. Manhattan, free will, and, you know, are we ever really free to do what we want? And therefore, does it matter, you know?
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the same way that there's a philosophy to Watchmen, I kind of started to develop a philosophy for Mandrake Project. And I shared it with Bill. And he was like, I'm in. And I was just like, I'm so pleased. And his cover is magnificent. And we bounced a few ideas around. And so he's in for all 12 episodes, which is great.
If you're leaving, close the door. I'm not expecting people anymore. Hear me grieving, lying on the floor. Whether I'm drunk or dead, I really aim to.
Well, this is actually a B-side on a purple single. I can't remember what the A-side was in the days when we had A-sides and B-sides. And it's just got this most haunting, beautiful vocal and this lovely, lyrical guitar solo. And that's it.
When a blind man cries.
Yeah.
Your favorite poet and painter, William Blake, also plays an important role in this project. In the comic book, someone tries to summon Blake from the dead.
Oh, yeah.
And also the video for Afterglow of Ragnarok, the first single, starts with a quote from Blake where he said, I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's. I will not reason and compare. My business is to create.
Yeah.
You quoted those words when you gave a speech as they presented a new gravestone for William Blake in London back in 2018.
I have a piece of it. They sent me a piece of the gravestone.
They did?
Yeah, yeah. not the one that's on, but the stone that they cut the grave from. They sent me I have a little chunk of it, you know, at home. It's great.
What did those words mean to you? I must create a system.
Must create a system or be enslaved by another man's. I mean, Blake was the ultimate bullshit, rebellious artist. I do my thing. It's my art. You can't push me around. Another guy I like was the character invented by Patrick McGoohan as the prisoner. number six, you know, I would not be pushed, filed, stamped.
I'm not a number, I'm a free man.
Yeah, I would not be pushed, filed, stamped, briefed, debriefed or numbered. My life is my own. And that resonates.
The Prisoner, which of course also is a Maiden song.
It was also a Maiden song, yeah. And that kind of resonates with me. And I like Blake because he was so uncompromising. He kind of messed himself up because, you know, in the end, he wasn't regarded as being commercial back when he was an artist. There's a famous letter he wrote, which is, again, is one of the best put downs I've ever heard. His kind of manager was always trying to get commissions to make him some money, basically. And he got a commission from some country vicar. So, could you do the seven deadly sins for me? I'm thinking, wow, okay. You're not quite sure who you're asking to do the seven deadly sins here. So Blake got as far as like the first two or three deadly sins, his version of them, and sent it off to the vicar. And the vicar came back absolutely horrified, going, my God, what's this? This is blasphemy. This is obscene. This is blah, blah, blah. What does it all mean? And Blake wrote a letter back saying, dear sir, that which is comprehensible to an idiot is not worth my care. And I was just like, yes, who has not wanted to say that to some guy who just goes, yeah, man, I just don't get that video, man. I mean, what's it all about? It's stupid, you know. And it's just like, yeah, you're an idiot. You know,
you've referenced William Blake before plenty of times. And, you know, there are quite many references to him in popular culture. I discovered him through Thomas Harris's book, Red Dragon.
Yes.
About, well, the book that came before The Silence of the Lambs, where the serial killer is obsessed with Blake and actually eats one of his prints.
Yeah. yeah.
Well, I think there's a William Blake quote in Blade Runner, or Rutger Hauer almost quoted it.
He's all over the place. I mean, you know, the Doors.
Which?
The band, The Doors.
The Doors of Perception.
It's the Blake.
Oh, yes. that's true. I actually bought that book. That's Aldous Huxley, right?
Yeah, it's Blake. That's Blake quote.
And sometimes I've wondered whether the Dio song, Holy Diver, where Ronnie James Dio sings about the stripes of a tiger, if that might have something to do with...
Tiger, burning bright, in the bosom of the night. Yeah,
which you quote in your comic book.
We've got the first half of episode one is out because I did a special comic for Comic-Con in Brazil when I launched the video. So in it, you know, our character Dr. Necropolis is in Blake's graveyard, Bunhill Fields in London. And funnily enough, the opening scene at the Artillery Arms, I was just like, I was in that pub having a pint after we rededicated Blake's grave. And that was a brilliant day because we had like 500 of the most eccentric people in London all gathered in this graveyard singing, you know, no amplification, no music, no battery powered, anything allowed. It was a magnificent day. And there was everybody. There were like the people who were like anarchists, and there were people who were like right wing conspiracy theorists. But everybody was like, yeah, but we all come together because we all love the old sinner. You know, he's great.
Did you ever speak to Ronnie James Dio about, you know, that tiger thing?
No, I never did. I mean, I spoke to Ronnie quite a lot. But
you were a huge fan of his.
I was a huge fan of Ronnie. Yeah, you know, and he was Ronnie was just this very special singer, but he was a very special person as well. I mean, he was really, really warm, and you know, there was no. There was no weird side to Ronnie. Like, he was just a really nice guy.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole.
This is a Trent Reznor song, which is now no longer owned by Trent Reznor. By his own admission, Trent was like, you know, I wrote this song and it was a pretty good song, but Johnny Cash sang it and it's his now, because who else could cover this song now after the performance? And the video is one of the bravest videos I've ever seen, about death and decay. And when Johnny Cash was singing it, he knew he was dying. He knew he was going to die. A little bit similar to the David Bowie song where he gets back in the closet and a couple of days later he passed away. But this is poignant and it's emotional and it's magnificent and it's so simple. I mean, the piano, that just simple dang 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 piano. I mean, if you had an orchestra, it would be less powerful. You know, it is so powerful sonically and everything. It's beautifully done.
I wear this crown of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You actually met Johnny Cash once, I think.
I did meet him once, I did, yeah. And he was every inch the legend, you know.
He was very tall.
Oh, yeah, very tall. Well, I mean, relative to me, everybody's very tall. But I mean, you know.
But he was the one who walked up to you, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, we were doing a sound check back in the 80s, early 90s maybe or something. And, yeah, there were these bunch of old guys, like, well, I say old guys, I mean, they were the same age as I am now, sitting at the back of the Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto, which has now been knocked down. And we were doing a sound check, and I thought, oh, I wonder who those old guys are. And it was his band. So they were just watching our sound check. And then I'm backstage amongst all this ice hockey stuff and old goalkeeper nets and things. And I'm about to go back to the hotel. And the guy goes, Johnny Cash would like to meet you. And there he is. And he was all dressed properly in black. And he had these thigh-length cowboy boots, like cavalry-type boots, and a big black hat. And he just came up to me and sort of like bent down a long way and said, hi, my name's Johnny Cash. And just like shook my hand. I'm like, I'm looking at him, I'm thinking, I know. and then he very sheepishly pulled out a bit of paper and said, couldn't have your autograph. My daughter's a big fan. I went, what? You know, and I was just like, yeah, absolutely, of course you can. And then he had this like 10 by 8 photograph, like PR photograph of him. And he said, thank you very much. And then just off he went, you know. And I had this photograph and it was signed Johnny Cash. And he was playing pool. And it was a shot of him playing pool. And it said The Baron on it. And I've always wondered, why? Why him playing pool? Why The Baron? All these years.
So he signed it as The Baron?
No, he signed
it. He signed it, and then it said The Baron over it.
The Baron was printed on it.
Oh.
It was a publicity photograph, a glossy photo, 10 by 8 shot. So I was, years, I thought, why? Why is it, why The Baron? And why is he playing pool? And, you know. So years later, actually about 2 or 3 years ago, I was in Nashville, and I was doing a spoken word show. So I was doing my one-man show, and I was in Nashville. I was on tour. I was doing like a load of American shows just after. It was still kind of during COVID, so it was a bit weird. But I'm in Nashville, where they didn't care about that sort of thing. So we're going out to bars and seeing bands, and the Johnny Cash Museum is there. And I recommend, if you're going to Nashville, I think it was about $25 to get in. It is a $25 well spent. It was a brilliant experience, a brilliant museum. There's all his guitars are there, his amplifiers, and the story of his life is amazing. So the kind of the guy in the gift shop is obviously a big Johnny Cash fan. He like curates the museum, I guess, or one of them. And I said, hey, yeah, I met Johnny Cash once. And I got to tell you, he gave me this photograph. And I never figured out why. And he goes, what year was that? I said, maybe it was like the early 90s. Is it? Ah, yes. That's when he was shooting a movie. And with the hat, he goes, yep, he was shooting a movie back then in Canada. And that's why it was The Baron. And that's why. So it was a publicity shot from the movie he was shooting. I'm like, mystery explained. But here's a great bit of trivia about Johnny Cash. So Johnny Cash did his like military service in the Air Force. So he joined the US Air Force, and he was in signals. So you had to be pretty smart to be in signals back then, because it was all dealing with different radio frequencies, and he had to learn Morse code fluently. So he was then he was sent to Europe, and he was actually eavesdropping in Morse code in Russian and German. So they were transmitting Morse in Russian and German language, and he was listening in on the transmissions and translating.
It's amazing. I would never imagine Johnny Cash to have had those, you know, that kind of experience.
He was really smart guy. Yeah. And after 3 years, he was a sergeant in the Air Force. That's huge promotion. I mean, he was a smart guy. And Johnny Cash discovered the death of Stalin.
Really?
He was the guy that intercepted the signal traffic that Stalin was dead and translated it. How cool is that? And that cost me $25 to go in the Johnny Cash Museum. And I'm like, wow, I never knew that. You know, it was such a cool, you know, I mean, but it's a great museum. If you're in that, if you're ever, and anybody's traveling through Nashville and everything, it's well worth $25.
Speaking of the Air Force, how much flying do these days?
What, now? Let me see. How do I say a number smaller than zero? Oh. Yeah, I don't have time. Also, I mean, I can't fly. Even if I did have time, I still can't. I can't fly airliners anymore. I'm too old.
Is there an age limit?
Yeah, it depends on which country you're in, but by most countries, or at least a lot of the countries in the world, have a age limit of 65 for commercial airline flying. You get to 65 and you are actually, it's a little bit of a pain, because you can't have anybody in the cockpit with you who's the same age as you, in case you go, die, you know. You have to have medicals every 6 months and everything. And so, in my case, it's all irrelevant because I have absolutely no spare time at all to go fly airplanes. I did it as a job. I mean, a lot of people still think it was, you know, oh, I just went and go and flew the Iron Maiden plane around. But I actually worked as an airline pilot for 15 years and had 6,500 hours of flying airliners, jets, you know. And I used to take unpaid leave to go on tour with Iron Maiden. I'd have to ask the company for permission. I mean, they gave it to me. They didn't mind. You know, I was like, because I had 2 months holiday and then I had 1 month's unpaid leave and that was an Iron Maiden tour.
But did you get that job because you needed the money or was it more like you wanted the experience, that you wanted to that as well with your life?
I wanted the experience, but unfortunately it's not a job that you can just go, oh, I fancy having that experience, because it's a pretty responsible, important job, but also because there's an awful lot of people want that job. So you've got to compete with everybody else who's desperately trying to get that job. So I kind of worked my way in and then started at the bottom and worked my way up to being a junior first officer, then a first officer, and then I was an instructor, and I was the technical pilot for 757 and 737 fleet. So I was teaching how they worked, you know, which I kind of enjoyed actually. And then I was a captain, and then the airline went broke 2011, and then I started my own airline, which was madness. And so I shut that one down after about 3 or 4 years. But we did some crazy stuff. We were operating in Djibouti in East Africa, and Albania. I mean, it was insane, but yeah, I don't do that anymore now.
You mentioned in the speech that you gave about William Blake at his gravestone that you once felt like Nebuchadnezzar, the mad king in William Blake's painting, who lost his mind through hubris.
Yeah.
When you once got really drunk and crawled down this hotel corridor.
Yeah.
And you just imagine that, wow, this is, I look just like Nebuchadnezzar, the mad king right now.
Yeah. Yes. Well, he imagines he's turning into a beast. So that shot of Nebuchadnezzar was like burned into my brain. It was the centerfold of an album by a band called Atomic Rooster, and the album was called I think it was called Death Walks Behind You, so I was kind of into that picture, and I was like, wow. And I was a kid, and I was like 14, 15. I had no idea it was Blake, but it's kind of art like that with some people resonates with you and it just like pervades your whole being. And I just remember that shot. And I was crawling down a hotel corridor in on the Number of the Beast tour in Japan at the end of an incredible year. So we'd had a number one album. I'd just joined Iron Maiden. I'd toured America. I'd never been there before. I'd toured all these countries. I'd never been to any of them before. And now I'm in Japan. And it was like, before I'm going home the next day, I was like really drunk and I'm crawling on my hands and knees and I'm looking for stealing bread rolls off room service trays that people have left outside the door because I'm hungry. I've got the munchies and I caught sight of myself in like this mirror and I was on my, and it was exactly the pose of Nebuchadnezzar. And I'm looking back at myself going, what are you turning into? And I went, I don't want to turn into that monster. So I made a decision that I was going to, not turn into that monster on, because it's easy to slide down into that kind of world of, drinking yourself stupid or taking drugs and doing similar things. And I thought, I used to have a brain once. I'm going to try and reinstate my brain.
It's really interesting that William Blake made you drink less, because I know so many people who like to quote Blake when they get completely wasted. You know, that line, The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, you see, Blake was, for me, Blake was quite probably quite into some of the, like, occult things as well. He was, so a lot of the people who were interested in things like alchemy and stuff like that, everybody thought that, you know, alchemists were all about turning base metals into gold. Well, that was the cover story. What they were actually about was looking for kind of the secret of the soul, you know, some kind of ceremony substance that might basically be the basic material of mankind, the basic spiritual material of mankind. That's what they were looking for. So when Blake says the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, it doesn't mean what you think it means on the surface.
On Eternity Has Failed, you sang about the eternal blackness beyond the stars.
It's
a line that reminds me of H.P. Lovecraft, or it's even like something that a black metal band would sing.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I know that you're not a Satanist at all, but have you ever, like, wanted to explore the occult in a more profound way than just as entertainment?
Yeah, but I don't have the patience. I honestly, when I was like in my like 14, 15 or something else like that, and I was, I read a book called Magic, an Occult Primer by a guy called David Conway. I actually bought it again recently to read, because it was a new edition, like the 50th anniversary of it. So I went, oh, wow, I'll read that, because I read that when I was like 14. And I reread it again, and it wasn't nearly as interesting this time. But you know, I did try astral traveling. Never worked. I used to fall asleep. I don't really need to do all this stuff to travel in dreams and space and time. You know, I can imagine it.
Leaves are falling all around. Time I was on my way. Thanks to you, I'm much obliged. Such a pleasant stay.
I loved the kind of pagan element of Led Zeppelin, the folky sort of stuff. And for me, this song epitomizes it, you know.
Ramble On.
Yeah, Ramble On.
Sometimes I grow so tired.
I was wondering if there are any musical ideas that you feel more free to explore as a solo artist than when you work with Maiden.
With Maiden, there are certain things I'd sort of go, well, that's probably not going to. That would idea might not work. With Maiden has a style, and if you do something which is going to be too far out of that style, it's never going to work. You're going to get people raising their eyebrows going, I don't know about, like that. So I have a sort of artistic radar that says, I think probably this is not, this idea would probably not work for them. Certainly not the way that I would want it to be done. So apropos of that, if Eternity turned into Eternity Has Failed, and I redid that song, you can see how I changed it from the demo version, which somebody somewhere will post one day because it's on the B side of the single Afterglow of Ragnarok. But if you listen to that, that's the original demo. I brought the song more back to that. It's similar. I mean, the notes are the same, but the feel is subtly different. So whatever song you give to Iron Maiden of somebody else's song, it's always going to sound like Maiden. You know, like if you did Paint It Black by the Rolling Stones, it would sound like, oh, it's Iron Maiden doing it. So we would give it that kind of spiky feel that Maiden have, and it's just when we all get together, we sound like Maiden. In that sense, it is similar to the Rolling Stones. They sound like the Rolling Stones. We sound like Iron Maiden. And so there's some things you know, you wouldn't, I mean, a track like on the album, like Sonata, I mean, never in a million years would that go anywhere near Iron Maiden, you know.
Also, you have this beautiful ballad called Shadow of the Gods.
Yeah.
Which turns into like a metal mayhem,
yeah,
a la Maiden, but it starts off with something quite different. It's beautiful power ballad.
No, exactly. And it's kind of cosmic Romeo and Juliet, you know, that story of Shadow of the Gods, yeah.
I was thinking of Maiden shows that I've seen the other day, and I remember this concert in Stockholm at the stadium in 2003.
Uh-huh.
And there was this moment where you were trying to say something to the audience and they just wouldn't stop cheering and shouting Maiden, and you just stood there looking both like embarrassed and happy and almost moved to tears.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen interactions like that between singers and audiences, but never really something as quite as strong as that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure if you remember that show, but
it's
really intense.
When you get moments like that, it's quite special.
You were speechless, basically.
Yeah, which is unusual for me.
But you're not always super happy on stage. Sometimes when you watch video clips from Maiden shows, you come across this bit of a, like a stern teacher,
yeah,
trying to control an unruly, very large group of children.
Yeah. I don't like it when people hurt each other.
No.
Because it's not necessary, you know. Some people get, you know, some people in crowds get not even over enthusiastic, positively vicious with other people. I don't know if it's because they get high on something, or sometimes people go to shows, and this is a bizarre thing. Principally, I think in the USA, but sometimes in some European countries, people go to shows who are very angry. And they decide that they're going to get angry when they're in the thing, and they start pushing people around. I mean, I'm not talking like the people who do the moshing thing, and it's all basically consensual.
Maiden is not really moshing music.
No, it's not.
It's not Slayer or Metallica.
No, it's not. But every now and again, we'd go out there, and there would be some like knucklehead, you know, in the middle of the audience that would decide that he was going to have his own individual mosh, and he'd start pushing people that didn't want to be part of that at all. And all of a sudden, you have a fight because this guy's an idiot, you know. And I don't like that. And I also, you know, I mean, I got into trouble in Greece for, you know, I shouldn't have said what I said, but I was just like,
so what did they do in Greece?
Well, we were doing this stadium, and you know, I'm trying to sing, and all these idiots were lighting these big like naval distress flares. First of all, they've got these things, and it's like basically phosphorus, and they've got them on ropes, and they're swinging them around their heads, and all the people around them didn't go, oh, please will you swing a phosphorus flare around my head. So it's just some selfish asshole who wants to draw attention only to himself and screw the concert for everybody else. The smoke is highly toxic, if anybody in that audience had asthma or any kind of breathing, that's like, you know, it's carcinogenic, it's highly toxic, you know. And it's also really bloody distracting if you're trying to sing to an audience and these guys are doing all this stuff. It's really dangerous, it's distracting. And then smoke starts to drift towards the stage and I have to breathe this shit in. And I'm like, it's my job, you know, and it's my throat. And they're here to hear me and the band sing and play, not to hear me coughing my guts up, you know. So I just got pissed off. I said, you Greek cunt, stop doing that. And I was just like, I shouldn't have said that. I know I shouldn't have said that. I don't necessarily know he was Greek. You know.
Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift. The baffled king composing hallelujah.
Yeah, on a completely different note about running around. So, this is, for me, one of the a beautiful song written by Leonard Cohen. Leonard Cohen's version is phenomenal. But this Jeff Buckley version is just, it's just sublime, you know.
Well, your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. And she tied you to her kitchen chair. And she broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I have some questions from my listeners, and not just any listeners, but the brave troopers who support this podcast through Patreon.
Yeah.
The first one is from Jonas Agebjörn. Which songs have been the most vocally challenging for you to sing over the years?
I could divide that into ones that are vocally challenging on stage and ones that are impossible to sing in the studio. Let me see. The song which was the most challenging song to sing in the studio was probably Quest for Fire, because it's basically virtually unsingable. And it's got all these like crazy jumps, because at the time when we would do that, Steve, I'm not sure Steve really understood voices. And we do songs in weird keys that I was like, but you have to do ridiculous things to your voice to make that work. So when we did a cover of Jethro Tull's Cross-Eyed Mary, for example, we never rehearsed it, so we didn't really realise that Ian Anderson's voice is, they did it in the original key, but Ian Anderson's voice is much lower than mine. So when I sing that song, it doesn't sound particularly powerful. In order for me to get some horsepower out of my voice, I had to take it up an octave. I was just like, holy crap, you know, like somebody put my nuts in a vice so I can sing this song, you know. So we're a bit more, when we write songs now, we do kind of try them out a little bit, you know. It might seem weird, but we didn't back in the day. I mean, songs that are challenging to sing are obviously songs like, you know, Run to the Hills and things like that. Aces High is really challenging to sing. And a lot of that is because you do stuff in the studio that's just like, well, I'm not sure we can necessarily pull that off live. Sometimes, I mean, I get, you know, I'm like 80, 90% on Aces High. It depends on the day and it depends how fast Nico decides to play it, you know.
And here's a question from Sebastian Elfors. I was at the concert in Stockholm in 1986 when Maiden was touring with the Somewhere on Tour. I brought a rubber skeleton to the concert and threw it up on stage. You picked it up and played around with it. I was so proud and happy that the toy ended up like that. Do you remember that?
I believe, you know what, I don't, but I think I might do, actually. Now you've come to mention it, you know, playing with a rubber skeleton. Yeah, that's great. That sounds good fun.
Finally, a question from Nils Seder. How often does someone shout more cowbell at you? He's referencing, of course, the famous SNL sketch with Christopher Walken as the famous record producer Bruce Dickinson.
Absolutely. Yes. More cowbell. So, not very often, but I will share this bizarre story. So when we played Seattle and we were flying the 747 around, the guy that is in charge of the production line for the Boeing 747 and the Boeing 767, his name is Bruce Dickinson. It really is. So I got to know this guy, and he said, would you pay a visit to the factory where we make the Boeings? So then we were flying a 747. He said, would you land the airplane at the factory and we'll have a big water cannon salute for it, because that's where the plane was born, basically, and then go and have a talk to the employees? I went, wow, that's an honor. Okay. So we loaded up the plane with the equipment and the crew and everybody, and it was like a little short flight from Seattle to Renton, where the Boeing production line is. So I flew the airplane there, landed it, I got off, and then another pilot flew off in the airplane and then went to Denver or something else like that. But I was going to go by regular schedule the next day. And then I went to the plant, and they'd shut the production down for an hour. So I could have a chat with the employees about, and there was like 400 or 500 people there. And all of them were given a cowbell. There was a ceremonial Boeing cowbell, and it actually has Boeing on it and everything else like that, and more cowbell. I mean, and they're all going ding, 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 ding. Like, you know, I mean, it's hilarious.
Why was that? Were they referencing the sketch as well?
More
insane
cowbell. I love this track. I mean, I love Tull and everything. And his lyrics are fantastic. And I had the privilege of doing Revelations, and I think it was Jerusalem, in Canterbury Cathedral with Ian Anderson, which is on YouTube if you want to go and watch it. I mean, I walk on the I look like a builder that's just walked in by accident, but it's a really great little musical moment. And I was a big fan of Ian, and I loved his stage persona when he had, you know, he had the codpiece, like some weird, like some crazed Elizabethan, you know. Yeah, Locomotive Breath. It's got great words, and it's got this simple riff, but it's and there's a lovely piano. It builds and builds and builds. This lovely little piano piece, and then it just goes into this, like, the piano goes into the riff. It's just I love it.
How long do you think that you will keep going with Maiden?
Oh, we'll keep going with Maiden as long as we can keep going.
I remember this interview back in 2003 where you said that, well, we'll keep going for another 5 years at tops, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
And you were 44 years old then.
Yeah. I mean, I think as we get older and approach the age where you sort of going, oh, well, man, we're really old now, you know, there's even more incentive not to stop, because you go, well, why would you, you know, come on, what do we get to do at our age? You know, we're either going to sit in the park, you know, drinking cans of special brew, or we're going to go out on the road and run around in front of thousands of people. As long as we can still do it without as long as we can still do it, basically, you know.
It's quite amazing, because your kind of music is very physically demanding to perform.
No, yeah, it is.
You
yeah.
mean your voice is, you know, you really use your vocal cords to the max.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's vocal cords and everything else. You're using your whole body to sing with, you know, so it's, yeah.
Would you follow, like, Abbas and Kiss's example and reinvent yourself as digital avatars?
I'm not crazy about being an avatar, you know, I'm not sure how you would ever turn Maiden into an avatar. A bit of a travesty of what we do. The whole thing about Maiden is it's not a band you watch, it's a band you participate in, you know.
Gene Simmons said something about their digital copies that will start touring within the next few years, that we can be forever young and forever iconic. The technology is going to make Paul jump higher than he's ever done before. Could technology make you jump higher than ever before as well?
Oh, that is so silly, isn't it? It really is. That would be magnificently ludicrous.
In May, June, and July this year, you will go on tour with the Mandrake Project. Is this the first time that you have a solo tour squeezed in during a long Maiden tour? Because you haven't finished the Future Past tour with Maiden yet.
No, I mean, we rejoin Maiden end of August. So I've got, and we've got a couple of weeks of rehearsals. Actually, the solo tour finishes like the 21st of July or something like that. It's actually pretty cool, because one of the things that I have to do when I haven't been singing for a while is get my voice in sort of like match fitness, to use the you know, like a sport analogy. So you just need to go and just do it a certain number of times to get all the muscles working. Well, actually, the best warm up for going on tour with Iron Maiden is going to be going and doing the solo stuff, because I'm just going to be singing different songs, but the voice should definitely be in good shape, you know.
Well, good luck with the tour, Bruce, and many thanks for appearing on this podcast. I'm so super happy.
Ah, well, I'm very super happy too. And now I can eat my banana. Yeah, and you have good taste in microphones. They taste really good. I was munching them.
Thanks to my brilliant producer, Daniel.
Yeah, because I'm looking at this microphone, I'm thinking, and I actually recorded Mandrake Project on not this microphone, but this very type of microphone.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Leon Media. Bruce Dickinson var hemma i Australien.